Simon, thanks for having me here today. It's great to chat to you.
Looking forward to our conversation.
So, Simon, I actually wanted to start out by reading a quote from one of your books called 0 Degrees of Empathy. I think also when it's published in the US was named The Science of Evil.
Mm.
So you wrote, "When I was 7 years old, my father told me that the Nazis had turned Jews into lampshades. It's just one of those comments that you hear once and the thought never goes away. To a child's mind, even to an adult's, these two types of things just don't go together. He also told me that the Nazis turned Jews into bars of soap. It sounds so unbelievable, yet it's actually true. I know our family was Jewish, and so this image of him turning people into objects felt a bit close to home." Obviously, quite a powerful thing to hear when you're 7 years old. And one of the main things I wanted to ask you today was to kind of understand how you became interested in, you know, the human mind and human behavior. Can you connect this experience or anything else when you were young to your interest and your career?
So the quote you've just read from my book, 0 Degrees of Empathy, that book was all about empathy and really trying to analyze what is empathy and also what happens when you lose your empathy. And obviously, you know, the argument in that book was that, you know, one consequence of losing your empathy is you become capable of cruelty. So the book was laying out a theory of cruelty, human cruelty, because otherwise it's a bit of a puzzle of why do humans do bad things to each other. But I suppose the flip side is it's a theory of kindness. You know, so I was arguing that empathy, you know, if you've got average levels of empathy or even above average, it could drive acts of compassion and kindness towards fellow human beings. But there are lots of either biological or social factors that could lead you to lose your empathy. And, you know, you started off with that story from the Nazis treating, you know, groups in the population, minorities, as if they were objects that could be disposed of. So, you know, genocide. And I was 7 years old when I heard that story. So it was bound to have influenced why I went into kind of psychology. But even hearing it now makes me kind of stop and take a deep breath, because even as a scientist trying to understand these extremes of human behavior, it doesn't really take away the kind of emotional dimension of these examples, you know, when people were experimented on as if they didn't have subjectivity or feelings or human rights. But that's just one of the factors that may have kind of led me to make my career choice.
Definitely an idea why you think your father told you about this when you were so young. Is there any particular reason?
So my father was born in 1930. So if you think about what was happening in the world in 1930, you know, Hitler had just come to power, 1933 really. And he was starting to pass all this legislation which was taking away the human rights of particular groups in the population in Germany. So he kind of grew up, he wasn't in Germany, he was in London. But then he went, you know, 1939, the Second World War started. He was kind of, you know, in a very Jewish community in the East End of London. They were an immigrant family. I think he was probably traumatized by everything that was happening, the stories they were hearing. So even at a distance in London, not in Germany, but, you know, right through his childhood, he was probably traumatized by it. And I guess when you have children yourself, you pass on family stories. You might argue, was it appropriate to tell a seven-year-old about the horrors of the Holocaust? But this was a very important part of who he was, of his experience. And no doubt it shaped, you know, his children and his grandchildren too. That's just the nature of trauma, that, you know, it often doesn't just stop with one generation, it gets passed down the generations.
What careers did your mother and father live themselves?
So my father was a teacher and a writer, but when my younger sister was born with quite severe physical disabilities and also learning disabilities, Susie, he gave up his job as a teacher because it was quite a low salary, and he went into business with his dad, actually, because he realised he needed to be able to provide whatever his disabled daughter needed. So he went into business. My mother was actually a yoga teacher, a vegetarian in the 1950s before it was fashionable. She was quite an interesting sort of alternative person. But yeah, I mean, I think they encourage their kids to just, follow their interests. And both me and my siblings have done that in very different fields.
Yeah, you said about your sister having some kind of severe learning difficulties. Mm. So is this another source of inspiration to maybe understand and help people?
Yeah, I think so. So she was next in the family after me. She was born with a neurological condition called Sturge-Weber's syndrome. Most people won't have heard of it, but it's, it kind of left her without language, she didn't really develop much past the level of an infant. She was in a wheelchair all her life. She needed 24-hour care. But she, and in those days, children with those severe disabilities, physical and learning disabilities, were recommended to be put into institutions, and that's what happened to her. But during the course of her life, attitudes changed towards disability, and she was moved eventually into community care, which is what we now think is much better. And so in a sense, her life kind of helped me learn a lot about, first of all, what today we would call neurodiversity, how there are lots of different minds and brains in the population, and how people sort of experience the world very differently, depending on the wiring of their brains. She may well have influenced my choice to work in a different area of disability, which is autism.
After your undergrad, you did an MPhil at King's College London in clinical psychology, and then went on to UCL where you did a PhD, and you were supervised by Uta Thrift, obviously a very influential psychologist. How did those that period working with Uta shape you and your kind of career to come?
Just as a small detail, it was actually the other way around. So after my undergraduate degree, I kind of wondered what to do, and I was lucky enough to hear about a job as a teacher in a school for autistic kids. So I did that for a year, and that sort of it was a really amazing experience to get to know 6 children in a lot of detail, and their families, and looking at their strengths as well as their challenges. And that kind of inspired me to go off and do a PhD. So that's when I went off to UCL and to work with Uta Frith. She's an amazing scientist. So she gave me a lot of tools, because scientists need kind of tools to be able to answer questions. And part of the tools really was sort of how to ask questions, how to really kind of frame your research question, and also make sure that your research question is tractable, it's actually testable, so you don't go off into sort of the realms of the unfeasible. But also how to design experiments. So her particular thing was, if you're going to study autism, who do you compare autistic people with? What's the appropriate comparison group? Or, and so she kind of introduced me to a lot of these ways of thinking. That maybe you have a group of people with learning disabilities who are not autistic, but where the two groups are matched for IQ, for example, where you're really trying to tease apart what's due to autism and what's due to other factors. So, great experience. And, and after that, I went to study clinical psychology, because I wanted to make sure that, even though I was intending to come back into research, that my research would be sort of relevant to real people's lives. And I thought a clinical training would sort of make sure I didn't just end up in the lab or, you know, operating in an ivory tower like this, but actually have a kind of a sense of what are the real problems that families face and that individuals face, so that research is always in the service of, you know, the people that you're studying.
That year where you're working with 6 autistic children in the school, can you say a little bit about that year? This obviously seems quite a pivotal moment in kind of bringing about your interest in this area. What were you doing each day? What did you learn throughout that year and so on?
I mean, I'll try and paint a picture of it so that you can imagine, but this was, it was 1981. Not much was really known about autism. And this school had been set up by a woman who was a bit of an experimentalist herself. You know, she was fascinated by autism, but there weren't any kind of obvious methodologies for how should we teach these kids and how should we understand them. So what she did was she kind of had an extension to her house, and the school was part of that. And she had cameras in every room of the school so that we could film every interaction between the child and the teacher. And sometimes things went well, and we could go back at the end of each day and review the videotapes to see what had gone well. But also often you might, you know, unexpectedly, a child might have a meltdown or just get very stressed. But it was, you know, you never knew when that was going to happen. So again, you could, at the end of the day, the teachers would sit in the staff room and review the videotapes to try and learn as we were going. So I thought that was actually, it was almost like a little incubator or laboratory for, you know, developing an educational method. And alongside that, you asked me what a typical day was in the school. So because there were 6 teachers and 6 kids, so it was one-to-one, we all took any role that was needed. So I was the minibus driver for the kids, taking them off to the park. Sometimes I would sit and teach them to read or do maths, but sometimes it would be doing cooking with them and we'd get our hands dirty and, you know, make pancakes. So it was very kind of hands-on, literally. But, you know, some of the interactions were really sort of thought-provoking. You know, that a child might come and put their face really close to your face, so not really understanding about personal space or boundaries, but without any sort of embarrassment. Or they might take off their clothes in the middle of the classroom, and again, without any sense of embarrassment. And, you know, that kind of got me thinking about a non-autistic child might not do those things because they're thinking about what other people would make of it. You know, that a lot of what a non-autistic person does is they spend their time worrying about what other people are thinking or thinking about what other people are thinking. And that kind of inspired my PhD into what then became known as theory of mind. You know, when does a typical child learn to take the perspective of other children, of other people? And do autistic children, do they struggle with that particular cognitive ability?
Yeah, your work on autism, I guess, has been the kind of core part of all of your research career. So I did kind of want to primarily focus on that. I thought it'd be helpful before we get into some more kind of details and questions, if we could just start off by asking you, could you explain what autism is exactly?
For me, and people might sort of give you a different answer to that question, but for me, autism is both a disability and a difference. So it's a disability in the sense that these are kids and adults who struggle to make friends and struggle with social relationships and communication. They also struggle with adjusting to unexpected change, so they can get very stressed if things aren't predictable. And, you know, sometimes there are co-occurring disabilities like language delay. or learning disability. So there's a whole set of disabilities, but then I mentioned autism is also a difference, that these are individuals who just process information differently. An example might be having excellent attention to detail, so they'll spot things that other people miss. These curtains, for example, they might have spotted, you know, just the little patterns in the curtains when, you know, for a non-autistic person, they might not be paying attention to it. And excellent memory for detail might be another example of just differences in how they perceive the world. Patterns. My most recent book was all about autistic people's aptitude in, you know, detecting patterns in the world. And, you know, that's not a disability, that's a difference. You know, we can all do pattern recognition to some level, but autistic people might be particularly attracted to patterned information, which could be an asset in certain, you know, occupations or activities. So, you know, I emphasize that autism is a difference in that we should respect difference. A disability in the sense that that's why they get the diagnosis, that they're having some difficulties and they're looking for support. But you probably know that internationally it's often referred to as a disorder. And to my mind, in the worst case, it's called a disease. And I don't think it's either of those two things. I think some of the co-occurring conditions may be disorders. For example, some autistic people have epilepsy or have gastrointestinal pain. And these things are clearly disorders in that they're causing suffering and that they're biomedical in origin. But I think autism itself, I would sort of limit it to being a disability and a difference.
So you've got these four things: disorder, difference, disability, disease. Just briefly, how would you define and differentiate between each of these? Because it does seem interesting important to distinguish them.
So let's start with the easy one of these four D's, difference. You know, in that everyone is different, and diversity is the norm. You know, so some people have brown eyes and some people have blue eyes. You know, one isn't better or worse, they're just different. And so, you know, part of sort of inclusion and, you know, respect for difference is just acceptance that we're not all made the same. And going back to your first question in our conversation, you know, when the Nazis were trying to exterminate a particular group in society, it's because they were trying to make sure everybody had blue eyes and blonde hair. You know, so they were against diversity. Whereas I think in today's multicultural and sort of, you know, very diverse society, we celebrate difference. So that's the difference part. Disability, I would say, is where somebody is struggling with skills. It could be physical, in the case of a kind of physical disability, but it could be psychological. Struggling with skills or, you know, things that would allow them to function independently. And it could be for developmental reasons, so factors that could influence the rate of development. And, you know, there perhaps the appropriate response by society is support of different kinds. So the fact that if we take the physical disability example, the fact that we now expect wheelchair ramps wherever there's a staircase, it's just an accommodation that society makes. It's not trying to cure the disability. It's trying to accommodate the person's disabilities. And we could try and think of the equivalent in the psychological realm of disability. So if an autistic person works best in a classroom that's not too noisy, we can design classrooms that are not too overwhelming. So that would be an example of just accommodating or respecting that people with different disabilities might just need different adjustments. And under the Equality Act in this country, but in many countries, It's actually a kind of legal requirement to make reasonable adjustments when someone has a disability. You know, take the example of sign language for people who are deaf. You know, if you're providing spoken language and signing, then, you know, both deaf and, you know, typical individuals are both able to access the same information. And then, you know, you asked about disorder and disease. So I think the way it's defined in medicine is that a disorder is something that causes suffering, but where we don't yet know the mechanism. And disease is where it causes suffering, but we do know the mechanism. So those are kind of just, you know, definitions in a way.
Does it mean that we don't know the mechanism for some particular patient, or just in general for kind of anyone who seems to display that kind of issue?
I think you can generalize it. It's not for the individual patient. So if you think about diabetes, you know, there was a time when we didn't know much about it. Now we know much more about it, about what causes it and about the, you know, insulin pathways. So once you've got a better understanding of the biology, you could call it a disease, but then you can, you know, then medical researchers can start targeting it as something that could be treated or managed. But, you know, there's still a lot of medical conditions where we don't know the causes or the mechanisms. So in that sense, they'd be called disorders. The unfortunate thing, I think, is that the American Psychiatric Association, they call almost anything to do with the mind that is atypical, they call it a disorder. So if you think of ADHD, attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, it's, you know, and autism is called autism spectrum disorder. And there's a lot of these things. And, you know, the word disorder, I think, is quite stigmatizing. And if we're trying to do anything as we make progress in society, it's to destigmatize, to make society more welcoming to people who are different. So I think, you know, there have been surveys of autistic people saying, what do you think about the word disorder, ASD? And, you know, you won't find a universal agreement on this, but the majority say that they don't like it. So these days I just call it autism. You know, it's kind of shorter, but it's kind of more neutral.
What do you think the general public's understanding of autism is like? Are there typically things that the average person gets kind of quite classically wrong about autism? Like, how informed are people? Everyone's heard of autism, but I'm just intrigued, how much do you think people actually typically are aware of it and know about it?
I think awareness has gone up really, you know, positively. So if I sort of backtrack to when I started, which is now, you know, 40 years ago, 1981 we were talking about, you know, most people hadn't heard of autism. And so the fact that most people now have heard of it, I'd say, is progress. You know, it's probably not a coincidence that autism has also become much more common, because back then we thought it was very rare, and all the textbooks said it was 4 in 10,000 children, so incredibly rare. Today's epidemiological studies, you know, population studies, suggest it's really common. So the latest data is suggesting 1 in 36 children will end up with a diagnosis of autism, which is almost one in every classroom, you know, in a primary school. You know, so in a community of, say, 200 parents or children in a primary school, you know, there's going to be a handful of autistic children. And it's really good that people are aware of it. But you're right that there's also still a lot of misconceptions or myths. So, you know, some people think that autism, you know, only affects boys because it's diagnosed more often in boys, but it can certainly be diagnosed in girls. And what are the other myths? Some people think that, you know, autistic people don't have emotions because they're characterized almost stereotyped as being super logical and kind of focusing on logic, not emotions. But actually, you know, autistic people have the same range of emotions and the same emotional needs as anyone else. So I think we've got a lot more educating to do for the general public, but I think it's going in the right direction.
That's good to hear. I mean, yeah, I'm intrigued, like, what do you think some of your most influential ideas and research on autism have been? You put out like a few different ideas, like around the theory of mind and some other things. What impact do you think you've had most from some of your work?
We talked a little bit earlier about theory of mind, and that was one of my early kind of areas of research. So it was really trying to understand autism from a cognitive perspective. You know, how is the mind of an autistic child and later, you know, adolescent and adult, how are they different to a non-autistic individual? And that was all about sort of the ability to put yourself into someone else's shoes and imagine the world the way they see it. So, you know, modelling what someone else might be thinking or intending or feeling. And that work, you know, later morphed into a broader theory, which was about empathy. And again, going back to an earlier point in our conversation, that book about 0 degrees of empathy wasn't particularly about autism, although autism featured in it, because it turns out that challenges with empathy are part of a wide range of conditions, including what's known as the personality disorders. So part of the way the direction of that work went was to understand that autistic people struggle with one aspect of empathy, which I call cognitive empathy, also known as theory of mind. So that's the sort of recognition part. When I look at you and I try to imagine what you're thinking or feeling, it's kind of the recognition part. But the other side of empathy is the response part. You know, how does it make me feel once I've figured out what you're thinking or feeling? And autistic people don't seem to have any difficulty with that part. Whereas if you contrasted them to psychopaths, as I do in that book, or people with antisocial personality disorder, they're almost the mirror image of autistic people. So they can figure out what you're thinking, and that's often how they're able to manipulate their victims. But they don't really care about their victims, which is how they're able to hurt them. So when you kind of look at these two clinical groups, so they've both got a diagnosis of something, autism and antisocial personality disorder, you know, they've ended up with a very different outcome, probably because different parts of the empathy circuit are affected differently, such that the autistic person is kind of confused by human interaction, maybe finds it overwhelming, and might even withdraw from people because it's all sort of very difficult. They want to make friends, they want to get on with people, but they seem to struggle with how do you do it in the right way, you know, and they don't tend to hurt others. I mean, that's really a really important observation. Whereas people with antisocial personality disorder might actually be very fluent in their social interaction. They can charm you, they can sort of deceive you, they can, you know, con you so that you end up handing over, you know, your life savings. Or they can hurt you, you know. So once they've got their foot in the door, having pretended to be the gas man coming to read the meter, and they're in the house, they might, you know, mug the old woman who's fallen for their deception. So the lack of empathy towards their victim, it's a lack of affective empathy. They don't actually care about how the other person is feeling.
Yeah, as you say, you've been working on this for like 40 years now. What are some key things that you've changed your mind on that you maybe thought were true 40 years ago? Are there any big things that actually you feel quite the opposite about now?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I mean, I would say that the research is always evolving. So, you know, in the early part of my career, I was focused very much on understanding the social aspects of autism. And sort of 10 or 15 years later, I realized that autism was much more than just the social and communication difficulties, that the field of psychology certainly had been over-focused on the social difficulties, but there was a whole other side of autism which had been neglected by research, including by me. So I kind of opened up another whole area, which is about what I call systemizing. And that's about sort of, you know, the way the human brain understands how things work. So, you know, all around us, we're surrounded by systems of one kind or another. You know, we've got some, you know, digital, electronic and mechanical systems right here in front of us. And people who are good at technology might have an aptitude for understanding those kinds of systems. But even if you just go for a walk in the park, you know, you're seeing nature, and that's full of systems of different kinds of trees that, you know, vary systematically, different kind of birds that vary systematically. Or, you know, if you're watching a pond, you know, what goes on inside of a pond is a whole little ecosystem. And that's a system. So, you know, what we were finding in our research was that actually, whilst autistic people were struggling with the social side of life, they were actually drawn to systems much more strongly than other people, whether it was mathematics as a system, or music as a system, or nature, as we just talked about, or taking things apart and trying to understand how things work and then putting them back together again. And actually, before we started our conversation, we were talking about the Rubik Cube, you know, and how that's a toy that lots of people like, but some autistic people are incredibly talented at it because it is a kind of algorithm, which is a very systematic set of, sequence of steps.
Yeah, this idea of systems interesting. I was just trying to think, what is something you could understand that isn't a system? I was thinking maybe you'd say, well, you know, someone who's very good at understanding systems that autistic wouldn't understand, you know, human minds and someone else. But are there any other examples? And if we do use that example as well, why would it not be the case that you could that another person could be a system? Yeah, it's another thing to understand. You can see how they move and their behavior and what they say. Is there not a way that this could be connected together in such a way that you'd understand a human like you'd understand a computer? Why is that difference?
I think you could try, but I think if you take a systemizing approach to understanding people, it only goes so far. I mean, people do try. You know, so there are aspects of human behavior which you could systemize quite efficiently. So let's take a dance routine in ballet. So it's humans that are doing the movements, but because there's a repetition to it, that, you know, you could actually sort of systemize it. You could write out the steps. Or in drama, for example, there's a script and then the actors say words that are in the script. So the script becomes like the code that predicts what the person's going to say. So there are kind of aspects of human behavior. Running a business might be a system where if you want to make your business more efficient, you might look at, you know, the business as, you know, what are the inputs and what are the outputs? And if you, you know, if you change some of the operations inside the business, is it going to be scalable? Is it going to be more efficient, more, you know, make more profit? So, of course, there are aspects of human behavior which you can approach as a system. But supposing, your friend has just had some bad news and they want to talk about it. It's not clear that you can sort of just take a set of rules as to how to have that conversation. Maybe that could help you start the conversation, but you've got really no idea how this particular friend is going to respond in telling their story about the bad news versus someone else. So to understand kind of conversation and many aspects of human interaction, I think you probably need a different circuit in the brain. I call it the empathy circuit. It's not following patterns, because patterns, you know, that human behavior isn't predictable in that way. So instead, we kind of tune into what is the person thinking and feeling and try and model how would I feel if I was in that position. But it's very responsive to, the person's mental states. And that's just quite a different approach to the world.
Has there been a kind of highlight of your career, something you're most proud of discovering, something that's been most fulfilling to work out and conduct research on?
There have been lots of, sort of wonderful points in the science of this field for me, and maybe I'd just pick out two of them. So we were trying to understand why autism is diagnosed more often in boys than in girls. And that was true back then when I started. People said it was about 4 boys to every 1 girl. These days, thankfully, with more girls and women coming forward for a diagnosis, that ratio has kind of narrowed a bit. It's now about 3 males for every 1 female, maybe even 2 to 1, male to female. But it still seems to be more common, autism still seems to be more common in males than females. So that led me into looking at a sex-linked aspect of prenatal biology, which is the sex hormones like testosterone and estrogen, which are known from animal research to affect brain development. So we kind of went down a rabbit hole of research to really try to understand, are these hormones, testosterone, which is an androgen, or the estrogens, but which do change brain development, are they elevated in autistic in pregnancies that result in an autistic child? And that took us about 20 years. So with a series of talented PhD students really kind of all working together and in series to build on each other's work. But it culminated in some quite important findings, so that we now understand that although autism is partly genetic, it's also partly hormonal. And that was a very satisfying moment from a scientific perspective, just to kind of, contribute a little piece of the puzzle to understanding the causes of autism. But I guess maybe a different example, which is actually much more current to what I'm doing at the moment, is about mental health. So about 10 years ago, we were looking at people in the clinic I set up, because we were worrying about the long waiting lists. People were waiting to get a diagnosis, and we were worrying about whether they might actually be so depressed that they're even suicidal. So we started routinely asking people, have you ever felt suicidal? Or going one step further, have you ever planned or attempted suicide? And then when we looked over a series of 400 patients coming to the clinic, we were quite shocked by the finding that 2/3 of autistic adults had felt suicidal and 1/3 had planned or attempted suicide. So, we wrote this up and we published it in a sort of high-profile journal called The Lancet Psychiatry. And that was in 2014. And we sort of pitched it at a very, it's called a high-impact journal, just so that it would get picked up, we hoped, by the government, that you can't just kind of leave people waiting to get a diagnosis without support, because look what's happening to them. It's kind of a very distressing discovery. It's kind of a scientific discovery, but it's got a real kind of relevance to people's lives. And so I've been sort of campaigning, in a sense, with charities that I've created to try to get better services for autistic people, because the reality is, although more and more people are getting a diagnosis, there's also these long waiting lists to get a diagnosis. And even when you get your diagnosis, there's often no support services for the disability side of things. And so what's happening is that, autistic people, they wait a long time to get diagnosed, so there's a delay in getting support. Some lucky ones get some support, but a lot of them are just given the label, you're autistic, and then just left with nothing. And in some of our subsequent research, we've kind of looked at the mental health outcomes, and something like 80% of autistic people, 60 to 80%, have depression or anxiety. So not just, you know, I mean, the suicidality is the kind of the extreme end point of a deterioration in their mental health. So there's a kind of mental health crisis, I would say, in the autism community. And I'm proud of the fact that our research kind of stimulated the field to start focusing on this, because it just wasn't a question before 2014. But I'm very saddened that in the subsequent 10 years, here we are, 2024, services are still abysmal. There's very little funding for autistic people or their families. The waiting lists are just as long. In fact, as the numbers have risen because the sort of prevalence of autism has increased, if anything, those waiting lists have just got longer. So we've kind of pivoted our research towards mental health and particularly suicide prevention in the autism community as a kind of high priority. It's the kind of, you know, research problem that can't just be kind of done slowly. There's a kind of urgency to address it and come up with some solutions. And of course, translate that research into, you know, changes in provision. So, you know, we're working with a charity that's called the Autism Centre of Excellence at Cambridge, where we take the scientific evidence, present it to the Department of Health and say, what are you going to do about it? And that, you know, so it's kind of science-led, but it's very much real-world relevant.
Yeah, throughout your whole career, I think essentially just focused really on autism, with obviously so many other areas of psychology and neuroscience out there. What is it that you find so fascinating about autism and that's kept you here for 40 years as opposed to kind of delving into some, I know you've explored empathy, it has some relations and somehow it's kind of separate. You can also talk about it without discussing autistic people, but primarily you've worked on autism and what's your fascination with this area?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, right from the beginning when I was working as a teacher, autism does present a bit of a big question. You know, because you can have individuals who are, you know, who've got good intelligence and clear potential. You know, we had the example earlier in the conversation about the Rubik Cube. But you meet autistic people who are very musical or very gifted at mathematics or, you know, fantastic at drawing. You know, so they're kind of using their systemizing. That's the way I've come to conceptualize it. To really show incredible potential. But when it comes to sort of everyday interaction, they really struggle. And the fact that you can, within the same individual, have such an uneven profile, because most of us are sort of just average at everything, you know, but and we get by, and then we kind of follow our interests and maybe improve in things that we practice at. But in autism, I suppose, there's that kind of, it's much more of a disconnect between things that they can do and which they often do at a higher level than most people, and things that they struggle with, where if they don't get help, they can really be quite isolated, and, you know, with all their knock-on consequences for their self-esteem, their self-confidence.
As a kind of last question about your career research in autism, a little bit of your work, I don't know the exact, you know, numbers of people or anything like that really, but maybe some of it's received a little bit of criticism from some members of the autistic community. I think maybe just best example is Spectrum 10K, which where you're trying to kind of get, I think, 10,000 samples of DNA from autistic people. Yeah. I think the primary concern maybe there was that some people thought this was going to maybe be used for some prenatal autism testing, which I've seen you write that this is absolutely not the case.
Yeah.
just intrigued maybe two things. Firstly, why do you think some of your work is sometimes criticized, and also how has that experience been for you when you know, clearly this is something you really care about?
Yeah, no, they're great questions, and you know, thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. So that particular study, we called it Spectrum 10K, so the autism spectrum. We were trying to understand the range or the diversity even within autism, because some autistic people are very verbal, but others are minimally verbal. Some have got, you know, gifted range of IQ, and some have learning disabilities. Some have these co-occurring medical conditions like epilepsy, and some don't. So we wanted to understand, like, what determines whether one autistic person ends up with one outcome or another. And the 10K, as you said, was about, you know, trying to do a study of 10,000 autistic people. And we thought, in order to understand both social factors but also genetic factors, we would need to collect DNA. There wasn't another way to do the study. And we knew that for some people, any mention of genetics could trigger fears. You know, like, why are these scientists collecting our DNA? What are they going to do with our DNA? We knew that ahead of time. But because this study was quite public, to reach 10,000 people, we needed to use different kinds of media. I think what we learned was, as you identified, there were some people who thought mistakenly that we were doing this in order to develop a prenatal test for autism. And we know, you know, that exists for other conditions like Down syndrome. You know, that a woman who's pregnant can have a prenatal test to find out if the fetus has Downs. And, you know, depending on the results of the test and the woman's views, or the parent's views, they might opt to terminate the pregnancy. Well, you know, I completely understand how autistic people might have thought maybe we're going to be next to be targeted in this form of eugenics, really. It's not compulsory eugenics the way that the Nazis did towards Jews and gays and other minorities. But, you know, it's kind of, I suppose, voluntary eugenics, in the sense that parents are deciding whether to terminate a child on the basis of some aspect of the baby's biology. You know, we made it very clear that wasn't our objective. You know, it's actually contrary to my values personally, but also the values of my research team, because we not just respect that autistic people have equal rights to anyone else, but we want to promote inclusion of autistic people in society rather than exclusion or prevention of autism. But nevertheless, you know, that was an example where if you study genetics, that's going to trigger those fears for some people. And actually, just to bring our conversation full circle, you know, along with other minorities in the population in the Holocaust, people with learning disabilities were also targeted. So we talked about Jews being one of the victims of the Holocaust, and everyone's learnt that in history. But less well known is that people with learning disabilities and physical disabilities also ended up being killed because of their disability by the Nazis. So, and we talked earlier at the beginning of the conversation about trauma, and it may well be that even in 2024, some autistic people, if they hear the word genetics in relation to autism, it re-triggers, it brings back that whole idea of, you know, that the government or the authorities are going to target us based on our genetic makeup, either to try and cure us or to try and prevent us, both of which they don't want, you know. So maybe it was inevitably controversial, but what we decided to do when we saw the reaction by some autistic people was to pause the study and to go into a kind of listening exercise to really find out, is it possible to do autism genetics in a safe way, in a way that has the support of the autism community, or is it just kind of off limits? And we're just emerging from that. You know, it's been a 2.5 year consultation led by an autistic person. So, you know, we'll see how, what the outcome of that consultation is. But, you know, I think sometimes research in human psychology will stray into areas which are controversial. And, you know, gender differences is another one. But I suppose it's just very important that the scientists, if they are doing research into genetics or sex or gender differences or anything else, that they're very explicit about their values. Because, you know, to have the trust of the people that you're investigating or working with, it helps if they know where you stand in terms of, you know, what your own morality is, and what your agenda is and isn't.
What effect do you think your career in this work has had on your, maybe your personal life, your life outside of work, the way you see the world, the way you interact with people and understand relationships and think about your own life?
Yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, I suppose a psychologist is not just kind of looking down a microscope at people, whether it's child development or whether it's, you know, human interaction all around. But it's also, you know, it has relevance to the scientist's own life, and I guess that's what you're asking. It's hard to kind of to measure, but I think particularly my work in trying to understand empathy has made me sort of realize just how important that is as a human resource. So obviously I try and use it in my own life, in any relationship that I'm in. But I also sort of see its potential application. So way outside of science, you know, I explored this a bit in my book, but, you know, empathy, I think, can also be the basis of conflict resolution. Whether you've got two individuals in conflict, you know, and they're kind of both locked into their different, you know, apparently incompatible positions, you know, empathy can be a way to sort of bridge the gap. But the same is true for a conflict between, you know, two nations or two communities. And if you look at the Palestine-Israel conflict at the moment, or the, you know, Russia-Ukraine conflict, or any conflict, you know, empathy could go quite a long way to helping each community understand the perspective of the other to find solutions. And we saw that played out in conflicts like apartheid in South Africa. You know, it took some remarkable leaders like Mandela and de Klerk to really understand the perspective of the other community in order to effect a massive, you know, social change, to the dismantling of apartheid. So, you know, that's an example where stuff that I study, I can also sometimes see a relevance either in my own personal life, you know, worrying about a friend, or, you know, how it could be applied at a more societal level.
Okay, and as a final question, I've actually started asking people recently the same kind of final question, just to get some different takes from different careers and lives. Kind of classic philosophical question, which is essentially, yeah, what does it mean to live a good life, do you think?
Wow, it's a great question. It's deceptively simple, isn't it? you know that when medical students here in the university, you know, are being trained and they're given the Hippocratic oath of do no harm, I think that's a pretty good rule of thumb for, you know, what does it mean to live a good life? You know, at a minimum, whatever you're doing, try not to do any harm. And I think, you know, I find it sort of odd that doctors who are being trained and then when they're in practice are expected to live up to this standard of do no harm. So it's not kind of phrased as do good. It's like do no harm. But actually, you could sort of imagine a lot of different occupations could benefit from following the same dictum. Whether you're talking about journalists who are maybe, you know, invading people's privacy, or, you know, I don't know, businesses who are exploiting people, you know, to drink more Coca-Cola or smoke more cigarettes. You know, there's a kind of, you know, do no harm could be quite a useful kind of driver for how to live your life.
That's interesting, yeah. So, yeah, because as a business, you could try and do good and maybe fall short of that, or maybe do some good, but at the same time have some unintended harm as well. But if you're just saying, just avoid harm, and then maybe that would then be no harm, and maybe some good would come as well. It does seem an more interesting thing to focus on.
You know, I think there's nothing wrong with it kind of being more positive and aiming to do good, helping people, for example. But I suppose that what doctors have to do whenever they're thinking about intervening with a patient is they have to ask themselves that question, could there be unintended consequences that could cause harm? And they're held to scrutiny or to this standard of medical ethics since Nuremberg. You know, so it's interesting how the conversation goes back to the Holocaust, because in 1945, it wasn't just the Nuremberg trials, but it was the Nuremberg Code of Ethics that was formulated, where it was no longer permissible to perform experiments on humans without consent, you know, and without thinking about, you know, the ethics of what you're doing. And, you know, we as scientists sort of looking at human behaviour always have to put in an application to an ethics committee saying this is the plan for our study, and we've thought about the ethics, primarily not just about the benefits, but that we've thought about could it do any harm. So there are certain pockets of society, doctors, you know, scientists looking at humans, who are subject to ethical scrutiny. The rest of the world, it seems like there's no regulation. And so I think, you know, there's a bit of a gap that lots of industries, you know, media, you know, I think we could probably look at social media, which is, there's increasing evidence that, you know, some forms of social media are causing poor mental health, might even be contributing to increasing suicide, you know. But are the people who own these platforms thinking about it and worrying about doing harm or being regulated in any way? You know, I think that's, you know, it's just an example, really.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, I really enjoyed talking today. Thank you so much for your time, Simon. Appreciate it a lot.
Thanks for your time. Really enjoyed it too.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you enjoy the Human Podcast, please consider subscribing. I hope to see you soon.